America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In the second hour of our program today, how much of America do we privatize before there's nothing left? Robert Poole is going to be with us from the Reason Foundation, arguing that we should privatize our air traffic control system. Oh, no. Yeah, later on in this hour, Medea Benjamin is going to drop by and tell us about how the federal government is retaliating against protesters. In the third hour of our program, we're going to be talking about, with David Bloom, the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, about how you can make gas for 40 cents a gallon. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, News Under the Radar. And the best of the rest of the news, Joan McCarter, contributing editor at the Daily Kos, and Isaiah Poole from TomPaine.com will be sharing their thoughts with us. In the meantime, just a few quick items, and then I want to get into the main topic for the hour. First of all, the Burmese regime. These guys are out there now. If the reports are accurate, and I suspect not only are they accurate, but I suspect that they're understated, the Burmese army, particularly since one of the a lieutenant in the army has recently deserted, made it over the Thai border and talked with reporters. BBC interviewed him last night, and essentially he's saying it's worse than you think. The army is going in at night and just slaughtering monks, dragging them off to prison in many cases, but in many cases just murdering them. And it turns out that there are basically two organizations that are supporting the Burmese regime, the first being the government of the country of China. And China is not immune to world opinion. Yes, China is itself a dictatorship. And they are not immune to world opinion. China, for example, just substantially helped broker this deal with North Korea to not just stop making nuclear weapons, but to shut down and dismantle their nuclear facilities. A victory of diplomacy, that word George W. Bush has never heard of in the Six Nation talks over there. It worked. So let's lobby our elected officials to put the pressure on China. The second, and Amy Goodman is reporting on this, over at truthdig.com, there's a report on it. I'm guessing probably also at her website and in other places around the web you can find it. Her headline is, Chevron's pipeline is the Burmese regime's lifeline. That Chevron is running a pipeline through there, and it accounts for a good chunk of the money that is going into Burma. And Condi Rice, of course, was on the board of directors of Chevron for 10 years. And in fact, there's a Chevron tanker, there was, until she came into the Bush administration, a Chevron tanker named after her. So perhaps the Secretary of State's office could be lobbied on this, and certainly Chevron could be contacted on this. And you can find the contact information on their website. So there's that. Interesting thing. The political news that seems to be a big deal all over the country right now, Hillary Clinton, according to some national polls, 33-point lead. Howard Dean had a huge lead at this point 4 years ago. I would not say that this means it's all sewn up. For example, here in Portland, Oregon, on the station where this show originates from, KPOJ, on our website, on the station's website, 620kpoj.com, we have an unofficial, unscientific presidential straw poll, and that we've been running for a week now. And anybody can go over there to 620kpoj.com and vote on it. And Hillary Clinton is running a distant third. John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich. Dennis Kucinich is actually way out ahead, 28% of the vote. John Edwards has 19%, almost 20% of the vote, 19.57. Hillary Clinton, 9%, 9.9% of the vote. And Joe Biden, 8.36, et cetera. We're doing it as kind of a survivor thing. Every week we're going to kick somebody off the island. And on the Republican side, and again, conventional wisdom on the among the Republicans is that it's either going to be Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani. But Ron Paul has 37% of the vote on the Republican side on our straw poll over at 620kpoj.com, three times more than any of the other Republicans. The closest to him are Sam Brownback with 10% and John McCain with 10%. So it's interesting. There's numbers all over the place, and also the straw polls that we do on this show. So I wouldn't bet on anything. And finally, I just want to note, good on him to Senator Russ Feingold.
Whoa!
Excuse me. Russ Feingold has just, this is absolutely great. He says, telling ourselves we don't have the votes now, so what's the point? Doesn't cut it. If we give in to the defeatist, we don't have the votes attitude, we're playing right in the hands of the president and the supporters of this war. The bottom line here is, he says, vote on Iraq again and again. If the Republicans so believe in this war, then make them vote on it every single day. Something we've been saying on this show all along, and good on you, Senator Russ Feingold, for saying it, and I encourage people to contact the senator and support him in that. In the meantime, there is a soldier in Iraq, a U.S. soldier in Iraq, a U.S. citizen. He was an immigrant to this country who applied for citizenship and gained it and joined the U.S. Army. His wife is an illegal immigrant. Actually, she came into this country legally, and because her mother married, apparently, her legal status changed. And, I mean, this is one of those things that just makes no sense at all to me, frankly. He's serving in Iraq, and his wife and perhaps their two-year-old son are about to be deported to Guatemala. And this is just a little bit of audio from a CNN report on this thing.
Gonzalez is a U.S. citizen. His wife, Mildred, is not. And she's facing deportation, wondering who will care for their 20-month-old son.
I'm scared, like, to go back. I'm scared for my life, my son's life. And I won't be able to see him anymore.
This is the type of situation that the government doesn't really get to see. They're telling families apart. And it hurts. It hurts a lot.
Yeah. So number one, we have an immigration battle in this country that has multiple sides to it. You have the racist right. You have the populist bunch who are concerned about the economics of unlimited illegal immigration. And I put myself in that category. You've got the racist right, well, I don't want to name names, but we all know who they are. And then we have folks who, you have the George Herbert Walker Bush New World Order bunch, both on the right and the left, frankly, who say, well, there should be no national boundaries. Labor should be able to go wherever it wants. Maybe not with citizenship. Not with the benefits of citizenship, but, you know, hey, if corporations want to hire cheap people and destroy the middle class, no problem. So there's basically these, and then the next step from that, of course, is free citizenship for all. And so there's that debate going on. And then on top of that debate, and this is where it's kind of layers within layers within layers, acknowledging that there are real people here who are involved with this. On top of that debate is the debate about language. Now, language is a dimension of culture, and I have actually considerable experience with this, in as much as while my mother's family came to the United States in the 1600s, my father's family, my father's father and mother, both came to the United States in 1917 as immigrants from Norway, and both spoke Norwegian when they arrived. And they raised my father only to speak English, and it used to just frustrate, you know, me terribly. I'd go up to Nuevo and visit my grandparents, and when they didn't want us to know what was going on, they'd speak in Norwegian. You know, it's like my grandfather had quite a thick Norwegian accent the day he died, and my dad never learned the language. So that, I think, is the overreaction part of it. Is they were so, you know, they were kind of following the Teddy Roosevelt thing. We only have one language in America. They were so afraid that their son would be an outcast or something that they didn't even want him to learn the language. I think my dad should have learned the language. I think bilingualism is a good thing. That said, I think that instruction in public schools and documentation, things like driver's license tests and whatnot, should be only in English. Should be only a single language. And I say that based on my experience living in Germany for a year, where we moved over to Germany and we put our kids who did not speak one word of German into the German public schools, and none of their teachers spoke any English at all. We were in a little tiny town out in the middle of nowhere, Stadtsteinach. The only teacher of any of our three kids who spoke English was our oldest daughter's English teacher, who had never been outside of Germany and spent all year trying to convince her the word G-A-R-A-G-E was pronounced garage. Garage. And what happened was, by the end of the year, our kids were absolutely fluent in German, so much so that our 7-year-old and our 5-year-old, when we were leaving the country, were mistaken by a waiter in a restaurant for native Germans, and he thought maybe we were trying to kidnap them. So absolute immersion and a single language standard, I think, is a good thing. And we should encourage people in the home to maintain the traditions, to maintain the second language, to maintain multiculturalism, to teach their children about the culture of their ancestors. Can't we do both? This seems like a reasonable step along the path rather than an extreme. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And getting weird out there. Getting very weird. Todd over in our chat room, which you can get to by going to TomHartman.com and clicking on live chat up at the top of the page. Todd says he just went and voted in the 620KPOJ.com presidential straw poll. He wrote in Higgins. Higgins, the attack cat, is now in the race. You can vote for him at 620kpoj.com. Oh, man. Anyhow, our question for this hour, should English be the official language of the United States? Should it? Should we say, now there are some significant consequences to that. What it means is that if it becomes an official language, a nation with an official language basically only produces all their documents in that single language. When we lived in Germany for a year, everything I had to fill out, from an application for a post office box to a checking account to all of our children's information for school, it was all auf Deutsch. It was all in German. I never studied German in school. I did not speak German before I went to Germany, other than, you know, a half a dozen lousy phrases. To this day, my German is Straßendeutsch, is street German. It's sehr schlecht. It's not all that great. But I learned very quickly how to get along. And my children all became very fluent very fast. And yet, at the same time, how do we prevent that from going over the edge? How do we prevent saying, yes, English should be the national language, and not having that process be a concession to, a suck up to, or adding power to the racists and xenophobes among us who don't want people to speak their second language, their native language, what would be a second language in this country, and who don't want them to bring their culture with them and hang on to it? Because speaking as the second generation child of a Norwegian father, I would love to know more about Norwegian culture. I really feel like I lost that. I missed that. Frankly, my father lost it and missed it, as did his two sisters and their kids. I think it's a shame. And yet also, I think it's a really good thing that he learned to speak English. I just wish he'd also learned to speak Norwegian and could have taught it to me when I was a kid. I think it would have been a good thing overall for everybody. So how do we make this conversation a rational one? I mean, here we've got this soldier whose wife, he's in Iraq, and his wife is going to be deported basically because of a paperwork screw-up. Why? Why the paperwork screw-up? I mean, why the deportation? Because there's all this pressure, all this hysteria about illegal immigrants in the United States. And so much of it is being fueled not by people who are concerned about the presence of illegal immigrants driving down the cost of labor in the United States and harming the middle class, which is frankly is my concern, but rather, oh my God, they're the brown people, or the Pat Buchanan argument that, oh my God, it's a different culture. We're going to lose our white Anglo-Saxon culture. Come on. White Anglo-Saxon culture is itself an amalgam of other cultures. There's no such thing as a pure culture. Arguably some Aboriginal tribe someplace, an indigenous tribe, but even that is a culture that evolved out of another culture that evolved out of another culture that has been changed by interaction with other cultures. I see our changing our immigration laws so that we can legally and methodically and intelligently bring people into the United States from a wide variety of places. We're going to be doing this show in March from Darfur, from the Sudan, from Africa. We should be bringing in refugees into the United States rather than cheap labor. There are people, we should be opening our borders to Burmese refugees if we could possibly get them out of the country. Maybe we should even do some kind of a Berlin airlift thing, you know, out of one of the border towns in Thailand. I mean, there are so many people around the world who legitimately could come to the United States and are not able to. Iraqis, we have created the largest refugee crisis in the world. 4.5 million Iraqis, 2.5 million inside the country, 2 million outside the country, 4.5 million refugees. There's only 2.5 million Sudan refugees in Darfur. 4.5 million Iraqi refugees, the largest refugee crisis in the world. And how many do we allow into the United States? Maybe 6,000 this year. So I would argue that on the one hand, we should say, you know, for simplicity's sake, for cost's sake, and for, you know, here's how you can optimally function in this country, that we say, yeah, English is the official language, and we welcome all people in all cultures, and we encourage at least bilingualism in our schools. We should be teaching a second language before children are 7 years old so that they can learn the accent and they can speak it well. If you learn a language before the age of seven, a second language, you will speak it like a native speaker. And you will have the ability easily to pick up third and fourth and fifth languages. And again, I've seen this with my own kids. Whereas if you learn that much later in life, it's much more difficult to learn multiple languages. It's because those parts of the brain have been pared away. There's a great pruning of the brain that happens around age 8. And large chunks of the language section of the brain get wiped out. So immersion, absolute immersion in the system, this is the way to really make it work. So should English be the official language of the United States? I believe so. In our schools as well. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Just asking any bar. Although I screwed the country, they still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors trust their neighbors. That's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing. And I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, a rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars. Forget about your cares. Let's go to Mars.
Yes, George, let's just go to Mars while you're tapping all our phones. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Participate in our blog, airamerica.com. By the way, Saturday, day after tomorrow, at 6 p.m., I'll be on the main stage at the Green Festival in Washington, D.C. If you're in the area, drop by and say hi. And I believe that we will have copies of my new book. I just got one of the advanced copies. Louise says, yes, we will have copies of my new book, Cracking the Code, which is the book that on neurolinguistic programming and language and how to use language, basically the art and science of political persuasion. And we will have copies of that book there. Pre-release. It's not yet in bookstores. So anyhow, that'll be there with us in Washington, D.C. 1-866-303-2270. Don in Seattle. Hey, Don.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
Oh, great. Well, I'm calling on the illegal aliens. I think we need a complete new identification system in order to identify people in this country. We need, now, if you come to the Seattle airport and you want to come ahead of time and get your eye scanned with a retina scan, then you can go to the head of the line when you do come in, because they
right.
they have an
it's
eye
the
scan.
it's called Fly Clear, and it's actually been privatized. It's owned by Hyatt, and I, you know, with some considerable misgiving, I actually did that, although I thought one of the reasons I did it is because I know that the government already has my fingerprints. They already have all the basic information on me, and so, you know, it was like, at a certain level. Okay, and there functionally is no privacy in the United States any longer. So, you know, I would trade that for a faster line at the airport because I fly a lot, and I suspect a lot of people are making that trade-off. But I'm also offended by it, frankly.
We need it for the illegal aliens. We need a DNA scan, and we need to have
online.
Let me tell you why I think that's the case. Because you can't fake the eye scan, number one, like you can a Social Security card, and number two, you can't fake a DNA scan. It just needs a strand of your hair or a swab of your saliva from inside your cheek or just a scrape of your skin.
Don, you're going right down the road to an absolute police state. This is like when IBM went to Germany and made a deal with Hitler to help him build a huge database so that he could track where all the Jews were in Germany. I'm very concerned about that. And then the insurance companies get a hold of it and they find out what genetic conditions you may have. I mean, once they've got your DNA, you're toast. And at least as long as we have privatized health care in the United States. And even if we had government health care, I mean, you know, it's whatever it may be. No, I'm not going to go down that road. It's not that hard to demonstrate that you were actually born in the United States. It's not that difficult to get a passport. And that you're actually a citizen of the United States. It's frankly not that, you know, not that difficult a thing to do if you really are. And we need not get hysterical about this. This is just like the Republicans getting all hysterical about what they call voter fraud and passing all these ID laws where you've got to show a driver's license and one other form of ID in order to vote. Well, the fact of the matter is last year they had, or in the year before last, the last election, they had something like 8 or 10 nationwide, 8 or 10 examples of somebody who voted illegally and shouldn't have. And in all but 2 or 3 of them, they were people who didn't realize that because they had recently been arrested, they were no longer eligible to vote. On the other hand, there's massive election fraud with the Republican Party now. In fact, it's interesting that this investigation is going up. The reason John Sununu is in the Senate now, as I recall, from New Hampshire, is because the Republican Party jammed the phone lines in New Hampshire, and then the guy who got busted for it was making all these calls to Karl Rove in the White House, and apparently Gonzalez stopped the investigation from going to the White House. So, I mean, you know, but voter fraud and citizenship, these are frankly not things that we should be hysterical about. I do think, though, that there is something to be said for saying that there is a national language here. Norma in Long Beach, California. Hey, Norma.
Hi. If we all go to Mars, what language would we speak?
Well, yeah, the question is, who's the we all? I mean, you know, you could argue that if you want to know what the original language of the United States is, it's one of the indigenous languages, but there were over 600 of them at the first time of contact.
No, I shouldn't have said we all. I was kind of being facetious on you. Said, well, let's go to Mars. I liked your song and your comment, let's go to Mars. And I thought, well, if we go to Mars.
That was what Bush suggested, you know.
But, now, on the language situation, I agree with you totally. My dad came over from Italy, but he thought he was brought in illegally, and his grandmother used to, or his aunt or something, if you don't behave, I'm sending you back to Italy. So he refused to ever speak the Italian language, and I, to this day, resent the fact that I never learned that beautiful language from somebody who spoke it in such a beautiful – his expert, and his English was just as good. So I agree with that. On the driver's license and the voting thing, I have suggested many times – that if somebody wants to vote or is eligible to vote or drive a car, get a license, request it in their language. We don't just automatically print it all up. Just request it by email, by phone. I don't know if you can do it by phone or mail. I mean,
I think all of this stuff should be in English, frankly, because that's the common language of this
country.
Exactly.
Everything in English. If somebody wants it in their language and they're eligible to vote or drive a car, they have permission to get it, but they have to.
Well, here you get this now it gets expensive and it turns into a huge hassle, and you end up with DMVs having to print things in 65 different languages, half of them lousy translations. And I can tell you, pretty much no other country in the world does.
My main
this.
Concern.
And I think, frankly, it's a waste of time. If somebody is not sufficiently proficient in English to be able to pass a driver's license test, I don't want them on the highways because there are signs in English. So that's one of my concerns. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to suggest that rather than use the word official language, we start using the word you just used, the language.
a common language.
Yeah, and the intention of that, as you know, as you begin to promote it, the positive intention and function of having a common language would be to unite everyone under one umbrella, and then that guarantees access for all. When people
the problem is that the if you use the word official language, then all government documents are in that language, and in public instruction is in that language, and it tends to have a unifying effect, a relatively homogenizing effect. And frankly, I see an upside to that in that people become more functional in the society and in the economy very quickly. The downside is that you lose culture. And I don't want to do that either. As I told the story of my grandfather and as our last caller said, and I think that is solved by aggressively encouraging and perhaps even mandating second language instruction. I mean, in Holland, you have to speak four languages before you can graduate from high school, and they begin teaching the second language in first grade and the third language in third grade. And you go over to Holland and you walk around in Holland and you can have a conversation with somebody in German, in French, in English, or in Dutch, and they are pretty much everybody in the country is largely fluent in all those languages. But that doesn't mean that the government publishes everything in all those languages. Everything is in Dutch. If you want to be in Holland, you have to learn how to speak Dutch if you want to become a citizen of Holland.
I do agree with that. I think it should be the official language. But in selling it to the country and not looking quite so racist and saying that, you know, English above all, that it does sometimes have that implication that use the word. And with the intention of using the word, it's a common language that we can all function in.
Yeah, yeah. Well said, Kate. Thank you. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom. Two words, acculturate and interculturate.
Mm-hmm.
First is, if you have everything officially in English, then you're going to force people to use English. And that means that they're going to acquire fluency in a language where we have some very special words and concepts. Like
right, which help define our culture.
Exactly.
So they're going to understand our culture. They may not necessarily become our culture, but they're going to at least well understand it. Just like I didn't become German when I learned German, but I understood the culture a whole lot better. I mean, you get a huge insight into German culture when you discover that if you say "du" to somebody, which is a German word for you, and they have not given you permission to do it, you're not a member of a family, it's a huge insult. And instead you should say "see," the formal form. And that after, you know, 6 months or a year or longer of close friendship, somebody will give you permission. And what that means is that they would literally die for you. I mean, there's like
right.
these cultural concepts that are built into language.
Right. My second language is Thai, but that's precisely it. It forces you, if you have to have the official language to do things, then you have to begin thinking. It'll just come up behind you and grab you. You don't know about
yeah.
it. And you'll
yeah,
think
absolutely. Absolutely. Very.
Second thing is interculturate, and you're talking about that with the second language for the 6 and 7 year olds. That
mm-hmm.
the other side of it is if we start to have to learn Spanish, that means we have to accept that there's another way of calling a cat a cat.
Right.
When you start doing that, you start, again, by osmosis, accepting the fact that there is a second way of looking at things, a second way of acceptable culture.
Right, which makes Americans less xenophobic, less insular, less,
right,
I guess
Tom,
those words are enough.
I had the privilege of going to the East-West Center, and that was their whole thing. They required that you learn, spend 14 hours or whatever on the second language.
Yeah.
Once you did that, you could not fail to accept the culture, or at least acknowledge the culture. Of whatever
right.
people were, you
because language is the crucible of culture, and it is also the seed of culture. It flows both ways. As you learn the language, you learn the culture, and as you are immersed in the culture, it comes out through the language. You're absolutely right, Ralph. Thank you very much for saying it. Very, very well said. 45 minutes past the hour. More of your calls right after this. Stick around.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
we debate about health care, welfare, warfare, child care, violence and crime, guns and drugs and secondhand smoke and daylight savings time, education, term limitation, where to cut and who to tax. Children just keep on falling, falling through the cracks. I know there are those public servants who've forgotten who's serving who. Now's the time we need to let them know why our interests are special too. But the family is the heart and soul of each and every nation. And we the people are the sculptors of the coming generations. If not us, who will do it? If not now, tell me when. We will make this world a better place to raise our children in. There is compassion, love, courage, concern, hope, and a giving spirit, and a voice for change that echoes still. And if we listen, we can hear it.
Now's the time. 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 Now's the time.
Now's the time to put children first. Now's the time to build some foundations. Now's the time.
Now's the time to take back this country. Now's the time to contact your member of Congress and say when Congress reconsiders Bush's veto of the child health program, the SCHIP program, that those Congress, those members of Congress who didn't vote for the thing first time around need to vote to overturn that veto. We've been talking about immigration and language, all these sorts of things, and which brings up the issue of borders. Medea Benjamin is with us with CodePinkAlert.org, one of the co-founders of Code Pink. And Medea, you've been having some interesting experiences up in the Canadian border.
Well, yes, trying to get across into Canada yesterday was quite an experience, and we didn't get across.
Yeah, by the way, welcome to the program. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much. Great to be on.
What is the genesis of this?
Well, it seems that the Canadian immigration services are now using FBI files at the border, and it seems that the FBI has put peaceful protests onto its list of criminal activities. So the combination means if you get to the border and they send you for a secondary check or they ask you if you've ever been arrested and you say yes, they'll look up on this database, and if you have been convicted for peaceful protest, you are not allowed into Canada.
So, wait a minute, convicted of peaceful protest? You mean convicted of something like disorderly conduct?
Disorderly conduct. I was accused of trespassing for trying to go to the U.S. mission of the U.N. and deliver petitions to Don Bolton. That was considered a criminal activity that's the one that kept me from getting into Canada.
Amazing. So does that mean that you're trapped in the United States, that other countries won't take you as well?
No, Canada is the only country that is using this FBI database as far as we know.
But the way that I'd phrase that is I'd say Canada is the first country that's using the FBI database.
Oh, right. That's a good thing. And that's why we got to nip this one in the bud, because if Canada gets away with using it, then other countries will start using it. And today we're on our way now to the Canadian embassy to protest. We have members of parliament who have just found out and are outraged and said,
good.
That just can't be the criteria that Canada uses, and do we want George Bush dictating our foreign policy?
Yeah. Now, there is some logic in countries sharing lists of criminals, with each other. I mean, I would think that we would want it would not be inappropriate for us to say to Mexico, for example, give us a list of robbers, rapists, and murderers, so that, you know, when people are asking for green cards, we can say yes or no to them. But political activists? I mean,
exactly.
Do you think that there shouldn't even be any sharing of information?
We looked at the criteria that are supposed to be on this FBI database, and it's for finding exactly what you said, sex offenders, criminals who have who the FBI has on their wanted list, and also for serious property crimes. But
so the real problem here is that the Gonzales Justice Department has decided to put people like you, Medea Benjamin, with CodePinkAlert.org, political activists whose only crime is speaking out for democracy, to put you in the database with the robbers, rapists, murderers, muggers, whatnot, with hard criminals.
And terrorist organizations. That is another criteria on this list. I hope we're not considered a terrorist organization. So, yes, it's the FBI's fault for putting these kind of crimes on the list, and then the Canadians should use common sense when deciding who is coming into their country or not. And that's not what they've been doing.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, Medea, thanks so much for checking in with us and giving us an update on that. And is there any specific call to action for our listeners on your part?
Well, yes, if they can go to our website, codepinkalert.org, we'll be putting up an action. We'll be giving people a number they can call for the FBI and the Canadian Embassy to say, don't blacklist peace activists.
There you go. Okay, very, very good. Medea, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Great talking
to you. Great talking with you as well. Gene in San Francisco, California. Hey, Gene, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. You were just talking to Medea Benjamin and... remember those presidential directives, 51 and 20, I think it was? Bush is trying to make an untouchable class, and by treating Medea Benjamin that way, that's going to be what happens. She's going to not be able to travel. She's going to be refused credit. All kinds of these things are going to stem.
This is what used to happen in the Soviet Union to people who spoke out. I mean, this is bizarre that this is what's going on in the United States.
The idea of the untouchable, you know, people won't even be able to help her because they will be put in the same class immediately.
Right, and what's the next step? I mean, under Presidential Directive 50 or 51, he has the ability to say, oh, she's supporting activities that might harm the economy of the United States, specifically the military-industrial complex, presumably, and therefore we can freeze her assets and she can't use credit cards. Yeah, it is absolutely, well said, Gene. Thank you very much. It is absolutely unacceptable. And go over to codepinkalert.org and check it out. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, how much of America do we privatize before there's nothing left in our commonwealth? We were talking yesterday about the real wealth of nations, the commonwealth. Robert Poole is going to be with us. We'll be discussing that topic. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. How much government is too much government? Or how much privatization is too much privatization? And how do we make sure that our airplanes don't collide in the air in the midst of all this discussion? Robert Poole is with us, Reason.org, his website. He's the Director of Transportation Studies at the Reason Foundation, a free market think tank, which he founded. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You note that the Interagency Joint Planning and Development Office has estimated the economic consequences of not dramatically expanding air traffic control capacity at $40 billion per year by 2020. That would just be, the inability to transport people and
that's right, that's right.
And presumably goods, you know, FedEx and whatnot.
The pipes in the sky are almost full, and without a fundamental change in the design, the concept of operations of how we separate air traffic, we're going to have to start rationing airspace capacity. And that means,
well, we're already rationing it.
You know, that means the demand is going to be way higher than the supply. And that
means we're already rationing it.
And we're rationing
airport space
right,
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a foretaste of what it's going to be much worse if we don't really make some big changes.
Yeah, although we've been rationing airport space since the 1950s. I mean, this has been around for a long, long time.
True, but, although that problem is a lot worse today than it was in the 50s.
Yeah. So your suggestion is that we throw this out to the free market?
Well, no, actually not. I mean, I am touted by defenders of the status quo as advocating wholesale privatization, laissez-faire in this area, and I do advocate that in some other areas. But I've studied air traffic control for 25 years, and I really think what we need to do is reinvent the system in place with the existing staff and the existing controllers, but change the way it's governed and change the way it's funded to make it run more like a commercial operation, but keep it within government and keep the same people and put in better incentives and a board that represents the customers and the employees, frankly.
So you're suggesting you run it like Amtrak. Amtrak is a private corporation.
Well,
Amtrak
is, but what Amtrak is doing is something that, given all sorts of other factors, is inherently not money-making. Air traffic control is inherently self-supporting, and it is self-supporting.
Amtrak is making a lot of money in the Northeast Corridor, and it's making a lot of money in the Pacific Southwest.
Amtrak?
Yeah.
Well, no, covers,
yeah, their trains are full. I mean, they're losing money on their long-haul lines.
The trains are full, but it only covers its operating costs in those dense corridors. It doesn't cover its capital costs. So that's why if somebody proposes privatizing Amtrak as it exists today, you'd have no takers because nobody would buy a business that's going to be a big loss maker.
But the fact of the matter is, in our air traffic system, the capital costs aren't covered either. The fees that airlines pay to park at a gate don't cover the cost of building an airport. When cities build airports, they take a loss on that, mm-hmm. on the assumption that the economic activity to the city is going to, and the tax dollars associated with it, in part are going to pay for that airport.
Well, the economic activity is a very big positive for cities, but actually, large, medium, and most small hub airports are self-supporting when you take all of their revenues, which includes not only what the airlines pay, but concession revenues, car rental fees, and so forth. They are self-supporting and they're able to go to the bond market, and issue large amounts of revenue bonds. They have investment grade ratings, most of them.
It's interesting. I was unaware.
Yeah, you wouldn't realize that.
So how do you monetize the air traffic control system? Because those airports are not paying for the air traffic control system.
No, they're not.
Which is feeding into and out of them.
That's right. They're completely separate entities. They obviously interact. But the air traffic control system could become a self-supporting nonprofit corporation or a nonprofit user co-op, if you will. And similar to what they've done, in Canada they call it privatization. But it's actually a non-profit corporation that if it makes a profit in any given year, they put aside some of the money in a reserve fund to cover them through downturns, and they use the rest to lower the rates for the coming year.
The British did something similar to what you're talking about.
The British did a bad design of theirs.
Yeah, I was going to say, they sold a 46% stake to seven airlines, but the government kept a majority stake.
Yeah,
they gave 5%.
It's a big system that has not had the incentives really right. I think you really want to have all of the users, which includes private plane owners, both little guys and rich guys, and the different categories of airlines, which is a very complex set that they all sort of have somewhat different interests. Cargo guys have different interests.
I understand all that, but here's what happened in Great Britain when that kind of a mixed system happened, was since there was this shared risk. Right. Basically, the for-profit guys said, you guys take all the risk, we'll take all the benefits. And they've had to essentially declare bankruptcy twice.
No, that's right. That's right. Well, that was exacerbated by the fact that it was privatized with a large amount of debt and basically no capital. And
the private sector assumed none of that.
The privatization took place about 2 months before 9/11. And the impact of 9/11 on North Atlantic traffic, which was the single biggest source of revenue for the British air traffic system, it just plummeted, and that really pushed them into, since they didn't have reserves, it really pushed them to the wall, and meant that both the government and the private sector had to stump up a bunch more money to put in.
Right. The other big issue here is that air traffic control is a natural monopoly.
It is.
There's no way that air traffic control can ever be competitive.
Right.
You can't have
two
competitive air traffic control systems. It is absolutely a natural monopoly. And therefore, all of the fixed expenses can be defined and quantified and improved by any governing body.
Mm-hmm.
The one variable expense is labor. And Ronald Reagan went after this big time. He said, Patco wanted more controllers. They wanted what was going to be essentially a higher labor cost. And Reagan used that to bust the union and say, no. Are you suggesting that the union should be brought back into the air traffic control system so that labor has a voice in this
Yes, I do indeed. And in fact, there is a union that replaced Patco. It's called NAFTA. and it's been very successful. And I do believe they need a seat at the table. They actually should have a seat on the board of an air of a non-profit air traffic control government corporation, which is what they have in NAV Canada. NAV Canada is really the best model. It's in its 11th year of successful operation, has an investment grade rating, is entirely self-supporting from fees and charges, goes into the bond markets and raises the money for capital expenditures, and it has this board that's essentially a stakeholder co-op.
Interesting. What are the other areas around the United States that you think that this kind of model could apply to? I'm thinking, for example, we have a rail infrastructure all over the United States that has become largely dysfunctional. I would submit in large part because of the Reagan administration massive privatization and sell-off of public rights-of-way, public rail rights-of-way. And, you know, this built a huge fortune for John Snow and
CSX, right.
CSX, thank you very much. And, you know, he became worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, the only government-owned right-of-way was Conrail's in the Northeast, which is, Conrail government took over the bankrupt Penn Central, which was the merger of Pennsylvania Railroad and New York Central. And then Reagan administration did a lot of trying to streamline it and make it able to be a self-supporting business, and then privatized it by sale.
But the actual rights of way, in many cases, the rights of way had been held by the government, and the rail itself was owned by the railroads. Was that not the case across much of the United States?
I mean, the history of railroads, all the right of way, and this is one of the things that's a big factor, a big fight ongoing.
The huge giveaways in the
1860s. And the railroads. Because the railroads do own all of their right-of-way and are fully responsible for paying the cost of maintenance.
So we have a situation right now where if you take Amtrak from Boston down to New York, they have to do this really weird out-of-the-way routing that adds about an hour to the trip because one of the private companies that owns one of the rails says Amtrak won't pay us enough, we won't let them use our rail.
Yeah, I mean, and that is really
I mean, how screwed up is that?
Most of the right-of-way in the Northeast Corridor is actually owned by Amtrak. It's the one part of the Amtrak system where they actually own the right-of-way. But
I mean,
as you mentioned,
Vermont
there's one
Boston,
part
I'm
where they
of.
Don't. And all the rest of the country, all the other routes, they have to pay freight railroads to get access.
So should we nationalize our rail system? Like you're talking about nationalizing the air traffic control system?
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, air traffic control is already in government. I just think we need to reorganize it better within government and make it run in a way that we've seen in other countries would work better. I mean, I think we have a much better railroad system today than we had 25 years ago, thanks to the Staggers Act that deregulated railroads and allowed them to become three times as productive as they were prior to 1980 when that came into effect. There's been a lot of mergers.
Yet the privatization of rail in Europe in England was a disaster.
Well, it was, but the disaster part of it was the infrastructure. You know, they broke it up into all sorts of different companies. The train operating companies are in pretty good shape, and nobody's proposed undoing that. The only part that was undone was the infrastructure, and that went back into government hands.
Yeah, interesting conversation. Reason.org, the website. Robert Poole, our guest. Robert, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Interesting conversation. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, the Washington Post, the New York Times. This is a major scandal. In 2004, Bush comes out and says, we don't torture, we'd never torture, we deplore torture. The State Department official position, the Justice Department official position, no, we don't torture. 2005, Gonzalez becomes Attorney General, And he writes a memo, a secret memo, a top secret memo that apparently was even kept secret from Condoleezza Rice. We're still trying to find out. Did she know? That says, yeah, fine, go ahead and torture. And the United States is now, you know, right up there with Robert Mugabe in the eyes of the world. And of course, torture probably accounting for why we had so much lousy intelligence on Iraq. Because if you torture somebody, they will tell you anything. It won't be accurate, but they'll tell you what they think you want to hear. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Paul in Maryland, you wanted to talk about Amtrak for a minute.
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, I used to work for Amtrak, and I'm a freight railroader now. Several things that weren't quite right. Amtrak is a quasi-government corporation. It was founded to be for-profit, never has turned a profit, receives a little over $1 billion a year from the taxpayers, and is generally on the Republican hit list every time they gain control of everything.
Yeah, that was my point, is that the Congress very rarely charters a private corporation. It presumably has the authority to, although the word corporation doesn't exist in the U.S. Constitution. Most corporations are created at a state level. Amtrak, though, is a federally chartered corporation. So it's one of their, you know, just like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac started out as, and arguably the Fed started out as. And so it's one of those weird hybrids that exists in the netherworld between an actual for-profit corporation and a government agency.
Yes, that's true. They also own the railroad, in the Northeast Corridor, except New Haven to New York, which is owned by Metro North.
Okay. So as I'm thinking back, when I lived in Vermont, I used to, you know, take the train down to New York and down to Washington, D.C.
I used to work that train, in fact.
Interesting. Well, maybe we've seen each other.
I was on that train for several years in the mid to late 90s. But,
yeah, well, we left Vermont
right?
in 99. Yeah, the Vermonter, exactly.
Right. Well, the Vermonter runs on the New England Central, which is a private railroad between Springfield, near Springfield, Massachusetts, all the way to St. Albans. It runs
right, and that's where it had to make that weird turn off to the west for a while before it could head back over towards Boston. It was kind of out of its way.
You can only make the turn onto what is now CSX there, and I can't remember the name of the town exactly. But, yes, it ran push-pull on the New England Central.
Yeah,
it was turned to St. Albans, but it ran control cab car from where it came off the New England Central to Springfield and down to New Haven, and then electric locomotive.
So anyhow, the bottom line is it's kind of a kludge there, but frankly, I mean, you travel around the world and you use the rail systems of other countries, Japan and Germany, the two most astounding ones that I've seen. Although apparently China and some of the new cities is putting together some incredible rail systems, and you look at some of the transport systems, particularly light rail, in some major cities in the United States that are publicly owned utilities and the transportation systems. And they're extraordinary. They're absolutely extraordinary. And they're more efficient than single user automobiles. It just seems to me that we should be putting more time, more effort, more money into that. And we need to be dramatically upgrading our air traffic control system.
Right. I would also agree with you that the rail beds should be publicly owned. Railroad profits are way up, but track maintenance isn't. And I think if you were to look at it, I can't say for sure, but I think if you were to look at the statistics, that railroad accidents and incidents, and especially incidents involving hazardous materials, are probably up over the last 10 years.
Yeah, and there's a lot of hazardous and radioactive material shipped. Paul, thanks a lot for the call and for your insights. Much appreciated. Roberta in San Diego, California.
Hi, how are you doing? You know, I love train travel. I've been all over the United States two or three times on the train over my life, and, I mean, to me, it's the best way to travel. And I happen to know that Amtrak was doing very well for around 10 years. And then a little over a year ago, George Bush and friends fired the president of Amtrak. I can't remember his name. He was very well liked by everyone at Amtrak. He was doing very well for many years, been quite successful. And they fired him and put in a Bush crony. I don't know these men's names, but I remember when it was going on. You know, the oil corporations and other Bush world people just don't want train travel to do well. They've got a lot to lose for some reason. I don't know what it is, but they'd like to destroy it completely. And it's really a travesty because...
Well, I think they want to destroy it.
Train travel is so special.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they want to destroy it completely because they want one of their buddies, you know, Jon Snow and his company or somebody else to make the money on it if there's money to be made. Ironically, oddly enough, and thank you very much, Roberta, for your comments, I just got my Amtrak guest rewards email. I mean, it literally just came into my computer here. Radio City Christmas Spectacular celebrates 75 years. Come to New York on Amtrak. Amtrak Vacations Deluxe Radio City Holiday Package. This is great. So they're out there marketing. That's a good sign. Step one, 27 minutes past the hour. Where do we stop privatization in the United States? Should we have an official language in the United States? How do we stop the business?
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number if you'd like to drop by our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com. Right up at the top of the page, you can click on live chat. It'll take you in our chat room. Articles on democracy, things that I've been writing recently. Scroll down the page. You can see our books. A lot of stuff over there. And also over at AirAmerica.com, the blog for the day. There's Nancy Scola's blog on the main page. And you can go to the Tom Hartman page to comment on the show, all this stuff that we hang out with and read. I'm in the live chat room right now. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
Well, first of all, I just got to say thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. I'm a huge, huge fan of yours. I just think you're absolutely brilliant. I want to talk to you about that young lady that was having difficulty crossing the border.
Medea Benjamin.
I just crossed from Detroit into Canada about 10 minutes after that had taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked the customs agent about it. And, well, first of all, I got a couple issues. First of all, I think that the reason why they use FBI files is because when people cross the border, they tend not to tell the truth about their criminal record. And if everybody told the truth, we wouldn't have to use anything like that whatsoever. And I think every country has a right to ask the activities of people in their own country to see how they're going to act in their country.
I agree with that, and so did Medea. We were both in agreement that it's entirely appropriate for countries to share information about who the criminals are. Where I draw the line is in suggesting that somebody who has been arrested for what in most cases is the misdemeanor crime of trespass or of disorderly conduct, crimes that tend to be associated with political activity, quote, crimes, that they should be on the same watch list with somebody who is a known associate of Al-Qaeda or somebody who has been convicted of robbery or rape or bank robbery or something.
Right. I understand that. The bent that I got from the customs agent was it depends on what the crimes are. And if it's multiple crimes, that's where the difficulty comes in. You know, somebody that's done it once, okay, that's fine. But when you've got trespassing, which can be many, many, many different things, I mean, that can be a risk to another country. And I also got to tell you, people that cross into the United States from Canada, I have friends that have what I would consider a minor drug charge from 25 years ago. They still get denied going into the United States. If you get caught drunk driving, you're denied going into the United States. Our rules.
You mean denied going into Canada?
Pardon?
You mean denied going into Canada?
Right. No. I mean when you cross into the States, your rules are stricter than ours are actually.
Oh, really?
I thought it was the other way around.
Yeah.
No.
Interesting.
Oh gosh, no. Oh no. You get a drunk driving charge, you're not allowed in the States. You get a drug charge from 25 years ago, you're not allowed in the United States. They ask is, have you ever been fingerprinted? And here's the deal with this. They don't even care if you've been convicted. If you've ever been arrested is the question. It's not if you've been convicted of something. It's have you been arrested? And if you say yes, you're into secondary, and it's 50-50 whether or not you're getting into the country.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, that's the world we're living in, you know?
Yeah, it is. And we need to figure out some way to separate out the people who are a threat to society on the one hand from the people who are in good faith and using the historic means that are the traditions of both Canada and the United States for bringing about political and social change, to bring about that political and social change, and who are not criminals but are political activists. It just seems to me that when we start cracking down on political activists, we're heading down the road that Burma is heading down. Obviously not as far, but once you start down that road,
give it time.
Yeah. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting. Oops, sorry about that. Interesting insight there. Kim in San Francisco, California. Hey, Kim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. First of all, I want to say this. I live in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and my life, I have lived in an area where whites are the minority, and I've lived there for 27 years, and we've lived here because we are happy and because we wanted to raise our child in a multicultural setting. Mm-hmm. That being said, I want to state that I work for a police department in the Bay Area. I work in records. We cannot deny the effect that illegal immigration has had on the African American community. If you look at record after record after record for the African American, especially the youth community, it's unemployed, 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 right. Unemployed.
Well, this is the thing that every time these cons come along and they say, oh, we can't find Americans who will do this job, I say, as long as there are ghettos in the United States, as long as there are pockets of poverty in the United States, I'm not buying that argument.
It's simply not true. Here's the situation is we are told that we need to get these kids education so that they can compete in the marketplace. Let me tell you a secret. My husband worked for the major telecommunications company for 23 years. All of his appraisals were outstanding. His job was outsourced a year and a half ago to India. So we are being pitted against each other. I want an end to illegal immigration. I do not support amnesty, but I also understand the function of corporations today is to externalize costs. I learned that from you, Tom, to externalize costs and internalize profits. When Walmart used to hire people for cheap labor, they used to give out government cards so that people could collect from the taxpayer. What's going on here is a government that has been hijacked by money interests. It's a simple
and by an ideology, frankly. Kim, I mean, the ideology is what started the whole thing. You know, the whole Lewis Powell memo going back to the 1950s, maybe the 1960s, to the National Association of Manufacturers, or no, it was the Chamber of Commerce.
And
saying,
National Manufacturers.
Educate us
on this. This is how I even learned about externalities and internalities is from you, and I bought your book, Screwed.
Well, thank you.
And I learned more.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Kim. And thanks for your kind comments and for the insights that you shared with us. I mean, this really is the bottom line, is that the problem of illegal immigration, and frankly, I think that that's a bad frame for us to use. We should use the frame of the problem of illegal employers, is another way to drive down the cost of labor in the United States. And it's really a secondary one. The primary one, I mean, anybody who is bloviating about illegal immigration or whatever you want to call it, illegal employers, should be in a much larger way be talking about the destructive trade policies of this country. And I will tip my hat to those Republicans who are pointing both out, like Ron Paul and on occasion Lou Dobbs even, although I think, frankly, he lets too many of the racists come in and do their rants. But, you know, what can you say? It's his show. Let's see. 1-866-303-2270. Doug in Seattle. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Tom. I had a quick comment about the immersion programs in school. In Washington State here, our federal dollars are based on test scores, and in schools with high Hispanic populations, they can't afford to do immersion programs because it lowers English test scores, and we lose federal funding.
Right, which is another reason to do away with No Child Left Behind. I mean, it's just the whole system has become dysfunctional as a consequence of this. Let's homogenize all education in the United States. It's crazy. Ivan in Michigan. Hey, Ivan.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, well, you know,
first of all, I commend you for taking a look at this illegal immigration issue as an illegal employer issue. I think it's about time people started talking about that more frequently. I think you're right on there. But the reason I called, though, is regarding the FAA and the privatization efforts that are being made by this administration. It's a mess. It's a bad idea. No matter how you look at it, it's just a bad idea. And the reason I say this is that the FAA is a safety-first, safety-critical agency, and that's its bottom line. If it's run by a business, its bottom line will be money.
Right.
You know,
yeah, this is why I'm totally opposed to privatizing the FAA. I was, frankly, I was under the impression that our guest, Robert Poole, was going to call for the privatization of the FAA, for making it a for-profit corporation.
Right.
He didn't, so I backed off a little because his proposal was at least a little more semi-reasonable. But frankly, what we need to do...
I agree that you know, to the extent that we can involve companies that have a great brain trust and understand what they're doing and take advantage of that through the government, you know, I'm not against that necessarily. But if one takes a close look of you know, at what's gone on at NATCA, the union that represents air traffic controllers at this point, and if you take a close look at it, I think, you know, the American people will see that there really is an effort underway here to gut a lot of these agencies from the inside out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that union does not have and that union does not have the power it needs.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think it's important to take a close look at the FAA administrator, the woman who just exited. Look who she went to work for, the AIA. You know what I mean?
The AIA is what?
I'm sorry?
What is the AIA?
The AIA is a gigantic lobbying organization that lobbies for aerospace and aviation industry companies. And they are the people.
A surprise. Another pig at the trough, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And ITT has just been given, I don't know, I think it's worth a contract worth $1.8 billion over a decade or so. I'm not clear on the details. But,
yeah.
You know, to start the new modernization, next-gen modernization. I did a blog about it at your site. At the Air America site. But it's
great.
Yeah, I think it's just more cronyism, you know? Frankly.
Yeah, it is. Ivan, thank you very much. And well said. I mean, this is where we need to get back to more of these Truman commissions and say, you know, public service can be a career and pay appropriately. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Children are being left behind as the Pentagon spends more. While millions have no health care, it wastes billions waging war. Corporate puppeteers pull the strings and chart the course as public servants sell us out without remorse. With public servants serving sales and forget who's serving who, we the people must change the course of human events.
Because our interests are special too.
Yeah, amen. Amen. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Strange stuff going on out there. Yes. Well, a state legislator really kind of blew up a high school class. He pulls out his computer. He's going to talk about, here's how you make a law in our state legislature. Sticks a little memory card in there, a little, one of these little USB memory sticks or whatever it is, and up pops a picture of a naked woman. He's like, holy cow, I have no idea how that got on my memory. Yeah. The school was not amused, and the state legislator is insisting that he has no idea where it came from. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Ken in Hawaii. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Hi there. I'm a private pilot, and I'm calling about the privatizing the ATC program.
Yeah, I'm a private pilot also.
Oh, excellent. So you know you can fly from one coast to the next. under 18,000 feet and typically not talk to anyone if you please.
Sure.
So it makes
as long as you stay out of controlled airs or the wedding cake airspace,
If you're above 10,000 feet and below 18,000 feet, you can pretty much fly anywhere you want in the United States.
Well, not above 10,000. Above 10,000, you've got to be under positive control, don't you?
Negative.
Top
of all the Bravo spaces are 10,000 feet. That's the tallest Bravo space in the country. But anyway, so you can do it. If the system's privatized, the incentive is not to talk to anyone. And in this day and age, it makes more sense to have as many people under control as possible. And that means as many private pilots talking to air traffic control, getting flight following as they can.
Right.
If it's privatized, and you're going to have to pay out of your pocket to do that, you're going to be way less inclined to do it.
Right. Which, arguably could be a good thing because our airspace is already scary congested. I mean, it's been at least 15 years since I've flown an airplane. But, twice back in the years when I used to fly, and I used to fly quite a bit, twice I was in near-air collisions, actually went under positive control, once in a cloud in Detroit. A plane just went choo right in front of me. I mean, and another time in Phoenix, landing at Sky Harbor Airport, I was coming in with a low-wing plane and below me with a high-wing plane, and we were both vectored under the same downwind final approach, or downwind for the turn base and final. And we saw each other. I mean, it was weird. It's just these occasional hiccups. You fly enough, everybody has stories like that. But the airspace
and
is
everyone's talking, and if they're not talking, it's even going to be worse.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Good point. But I agree with you. I think privatization would be a disaster. The other thing is that corporate private jets right now.
There are thousands and thousands of private pilots who fly every single day, and that it's to the advantage of the American public to have as many of those people in contact with ATC as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is that corporate private jets and corporate private planes, particularly fancy ones, but private jet is a booming industry right now. I mean, it's just absolutely exploding, and it's adding to the burden of the system overall, and which is a whole separate discussion of, should they be paying into the air traffic control system, and how much should they be paying for landing rights at airports and all that kind of thing. But Ken, good point and well made. Thank you very much. Al in San Diego, California. Hey, Al.
How you doing, Tom? Nice to meet you.
Fine. Thank you.
Oh, yes. As far as English being the official language, I don't have anything against people speaking their native tongue or anything like that, but it's a matter of practicality. Only because, for instance, this job I work at, I work with many people from different countries. And I work with a lot of Hispanics. They all speak their native language among each other. But when we listen to our employer and we have instructions to do, we do it in English.
Yeah, and that's a great thing. And in fact, English is the default language of international commerce. Speaking of air traffic control, English is the language that is spoken by air traffic control towers all over the world, even in China. So by immersing people in English and getting them fluent in English, we're actually increasing their ability to compete in the global economy. I mean, we're actually, I would argue, doing them a favor. I think it's a good thing. Mike in Lomita, California. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Tom. Happy St. Patrick's, or St. Francis Day to Higgins.
Yes.
To answer your earlier question about which should be our official language, I think it's the native tongue of the place where the Declaration of Independence and U.S. Constitution were drafted, and arguably is the source of the oldest work of American literature, and that's Delaware, or Lenape, Anishi.
Lenape is the, of the Delaware people, that's their language?
I beg pardon?
Delaware is the language of the, is,
the native
Lenape
people.
Is the, yeah, is the name
yeah,
of that
that's
language.
That's their word for it. Delaware is from an English nobleman.
Yeah. You know, this really raises a larger issue, Mike, which is what should the status of what we refer to as Indian reservations in the United States be? I'm strongly inclined to want to go a step beyond where we've gone in the United States, in the direction that Canada has gone in what used to be the Northwest Territories, and give sovereignty, or, much more sovereignty to Native American communities. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it sounds very intriguing.
I'm wondering what the fallout would be in areas like California, where we have very large gambling operations, for a few, and relatively little in the way of material wherewithal for the others.
And poverty in others, yeah. Part of the problem is that when you've destroyed a culture, when you've shattered it, when you've busted it up, when you've stolen its land, when you've destroyed its people, and then you say, oh, and here, by the way, you know, it just doesn't work quite as well. But I think that we all need to remember that the first great genocide in this country was of the Native Americans. Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And, you know, your point is well taken. Impractical, but well taken. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So where do we take our country from here, particularly given the fact that we are dependent upon Middle Eastern oil? Gee, what a surprise, we're fighting a war in the Middle East. We're dependent on Venezuelan oil. Gee, what a surprise, we're in a spitting war with Hugo Chavez. Looks like there might be oil off the coast of Cuba. Hey, suddenly we're thinking about getting friendly with Cuba. Mexico has a lot of oil, and we're messing in their elections, helping them elect a right-wing president. Biofuels, wind, all these things on the table. David Bloom has been looking at this for a long, long time. He's the author of the book Alcohol Can Be a Gas. AlcoholCanBeAGas.com is the website. He's in our studio here today because tonight he's here in Portland speaking at Powell's Technical Books at 7 p.m. at their technical bookstore. And he's doing an all-day workshop at Portland State University tomorrow and at the University of Portland on Sunday. He's got a speaking gig. So, David, welcome to the program.
Well, good to be here again, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Your book has an introduction by R. Buckminster Fuller, good old Bucky Fuller. How did you get Bucky Fuller to write a foreword to your book when he's been dead for a decade?
Well, actually, this is not the first attempt at getting this book out. I used to teach workshops around the country in alcohol fuel and then did a 10-part series for PBS on how to produce alcohol. The theory was to have the revolution on television, you know.
Sure.
And part of the effort of doing that was involving Buckminster Fuller, who I'd been corresponding with for some time around alcohol fuel, and he wrote the foreword for the book. The reason why the book didn't come out in 1983, when the TV series first aired on San Francisco PBS station KQED, is that when the fourth segment was airing, Chevron saw it and basically said to PBS, "What's wrong? You don't like our money?" And basically they took the book tag off the end of the show. I was at the printer here in Oregon. In fact, the Oregonian used to print books back then, mm-hmm. So it was going to be printed here. And they stopped it right at the press. And, you know, this happened in 1983. Now, you know, nowadays we would say, well, of course, Dave. I mean, how do you expect to, you know, do the revolution on television? But, you know, we had an illusion of a free press back in 1983. And it was a little different then.
Yeah, a little more of an illusion of it. Mm-hmm. And now, one of the points that you make in the book is that alcohol is, well, actually, before we get to the alcohol, is that gasoline is a waste product.
Oh, yeah, it always has been. You know, when the oil industry started, Rockefeller used to make basically kerosene for lamps and for heating, and everything that was kind of volatile that would make oil lamps explode, well, nobody wanted that, so he'd flush that into the rivers at night. Well, when the internal combustion engine came around, he found that, you know, although it was designed to run on alcohol, if he messed around with it enough, he could get it to run on gasoline, and since it was just toxic waste, he could sell it cheap. So in the early part of the 1900s and the late 1800s, you'd only find gasoline in cities where he was distributing his oil. But out in the countryside, if you wanted to get home, you had to stop by a farm and get alcohol. The Model A, from the start, was able to run on both alcohol and gasoline.
Right, and all the original cars, the first generation of cars in the United States, were all alcohol vehicles.
That's right. Gasoline came later. You know, alcohol was the first fuel.
And you also point out that a waste product. Gasoline represents a fairly small percentage of the value of a barrel of oil.
Oh, yeah, this is something the oil company hates talking about. We have in our book, we have a reproduction from Dow Chemical, which showed what comes out of a barrel of oil. And basically, the important products out of a barrel of oil, and this was in 1983, the study came out, showed were $25,000 worth of things, things like nylon stockings, pesticides, et cetera, and only $106 came out of the barrel of oil as fuel. So, you know, today it's the same deal. What we're doing nowadays with gasoline is whenever you make all these other products, whatever toxic stuff's left over is thrown together and they call it gasoline, and then we pay for the privilege of disposing of the oil company's toxic waste.
And there is no such one such thing as gasoline. For example, the stuff that we burn in our cars here in Portland, Oregon, has 35 times more benzene, which is a carcinogen, and adds no value at all to putting it in a car. It's simply expensive to dispose of in a toxic waste site, and so they put it in our gasoline. 35 times more benzene in it than does the gasoline burned down in Los Angeles, which has laws that regulate the amount of benzene.
Yes, we have quite a bit of benzene, too, but not as much as up here. And nowadays, you know, with peak oil, a lot of other garbage is being put into the fuel. For instance, until the late 60s, early 70s, you never saw natural gas condensates being added to gasoline because these are cyclobenzene, cyclohexane, pentane, et cetera.
These are carcinogens.
Carcinogens.
Potent carcinogens.
And very volatile, making the gasoline more evaporative so it would get into the air easier. So it used to be illegal to put this stuff in the gas. Well, if you take a look at all the peak oil charts, you'll see a larger and larger percentage, both now and into the future, of what we now call conventional gasoline is going to be natural gas condensate, stuff that they can't get rid of in natural gas. So, you know, yes, we're putting more
garbage. It's the waste byproducts of the natural gas industry.
Absolutely.
So gasoline started out as the waste byproduct of the oil industry and still is to a large extent. Most of the money that the oil industry makes is not on gasoline. It's on making oil into plastics and fertilizers and things like that, and their waste product is gasoline. And now the natural gas industry has this condensate, presumably from their pipelines and compression and whatnot, and that they would otherwise have to pay to dispose of, and they're tossing that into gasoline. Right, or they used to flare it. And the consequence of this is millions of cancers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Huge, huge amount of cancer. And, you know, when you start looking at two-stroke engines, like your chainsaws, et cetera, you know, those engines actually, because they're not like a car engine, which is a four-stroke engine, some of the unburned mixture goes out in the exhaust because of the way it's
done. So you're actually inhaling raw gasoline.
Raw benzene and raw xylene and raw toluene, all the stuff that they put into gasoline now because the oil that we're now using is such low quality that to bring the octane up, they have to increase the amount of these carcinogens because they're high octane. And the replacement for that, of course, is alcohol. Alcohol is 105 octane, and the oil companies hate it because you only need a small amount of alcohol to get the same octane increase as BTX.
Right.
Well,
now
that means less gallons to sell.
Right. Now, we only have about 2 minutes here left. We're talking David Bloom. He's the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Let's get right to alcohol. The big argument being that I'm hearing against alcohol is that it is the least efficient of the gases, that of the fuels that can be made, that the diesels are more efficient because it requires at least in temperate climates. In on the equator, it might be more efficient to make from sugarcane and things. But in the north, it's not as efficient.
No, that's not true at all. There's only one scientist that says that it's energy inefficient to make alcohol, David Pimentel, and he's a laughing stock in the world of energy. And in fact, he was exposed by George McGovern back in the 80s for falsifying a report to the DOE about this. But whenever he speaks, the American Petroleum Institute sends out 10,000 press releases. The reality is that we get 8 units of energy out for every unit of energy in when it comes to sugarcane. And if we go ahead and use renewable energy to power our alcohol plants, which we can do and we're starting to do, and as is done in the rest of the world, we're looking at 10, 12, 15 to 1 units out for 1 unit in.
Right, but you can't grow sugarcane in most of the United States.
No, but you can grow sorghum. And sorghum is temperate sugarcane, basically. And we can get 700 or 800 gallons to 1,000 gallons an acre from that. In my book, I go over 20 different crops that are better than corn for making alcohol. The only reason why we're using corn now is that we currently have a lot of it. So
because it's subsidized by the government.
Well,
and ADM,
you know, it is
big,
but it's like if you're a farmer in the Midwest, you got a, you know, there's 4 companies that buy basically all the products that farmers grow in the Midwest, and they buy it for animal feed.
Right.
So you got a choice. You can grow corn, you can grow soybeans, or you can grow corn. So, you know, in California, we used to, like, you know, diss, I was a farmer in California for many years, we used to diss the Midwest guys saying, well, you guys ought to grow broccoli and stuff like that. And the answer is, who would buy it? Because the granary at the end of town is the only market for what you can grow on all this acreage. So we grow stuff that's
all about
want.
The distribution.
But now alcohol fuel changes that equation, because now there's a new buyer on the block. Now, if you have an alcohol plant, and the same alcohol plant can use sorghum, sugar beets, Jerusalem artichokes, any number of other crops, this is very interesting because the diversity of crops in the Midwest would be an end to monoculture. It would.
It could open it all up. We have about a half a minute. We're talking with David Bloom, author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. David, today's Wall Street Journal, an article about how the alcohol and other fuels prices are going up because of a shortage of them.
Well, that's interesting because the New York Times the other day said the price was going down because there's a glut of them. And
oh, that's interesting.
If there's only thing, there's one thing you can say about alcohol is that there is so much misinformation out there that it's hard to get the straight story. And that's why I wrote a book to clear all this stuff up, because it's amazing the stuff that flies out there. I mean, I heard on your show one day a caller came in and said the byproduct from alcohol fuel production is high fructose corn syrup. And it's like, excuse me, it's like you make either high fructose corn syrup or alcohol,
right,
but not both from
right.
starch.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff that floats around is just amazing, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there. So if you want the whole story, pick up the book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. In fact, you'll find a nice little blurb I wrote on the front page of it by David Bloom. Or check out the website, alcoholcanbeagas, just like it sounds, .com. And if you're in the Portland area, stop by Powell's Technical Books tonight at 7 p.m. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. And coming up next, we have Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Radio, 21 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, where she also creates the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am great. Great to have you with us, Christy.
I don't know if you saw the breaking news. Did you see that Larry Craig's judge said, no way, you got your guilty plea, you got to keep it?
Oh, really?
Yes, this just happened a couple of minutes ago. I just got a breaking news thing from one of the wire services.
So does this mean he's actually going to resign from the Senate?
Who knows? You know, he's had such a wide stance on all of this that I have no idea what's going to happen there. But I did think that it was very interesting that the judge said, thank you so much for playing, sir. But, yeah, you pled guilty, you're guilty.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And speaking of wide stances, the Minneapolis airport, $25,000 a stall.
It's going to cost them $25,000 to put bathroom stalls that go from ceiling to floor between the bathroom stalls there so that they can, you know, protect frequent flyers from congressmen with the wide stances.
it's
the toe tap barrier.
this is what Minneapolis is doing to get ready for the Republican convention.
Poor Larry
Craig, I guarantee you, is not the only Republican who's doing this.
I love it. I love that that's his legacy too. Bless his heart.
Indeed, indeed. Portland, Oregon, Phoenix, Arizona. Repeat after me. This is only a test. I've been getting so many calls about this. People are concerned that low-level radiation is going to be released, that this is the planning for the fascist takeover, that this is the beginning of the end, that this is the setup for when Bush declares martial law. What's the deal here with Top Off?
Okay, Top Off is, it's going to be the biggest one we've had yet, but it's one of these four congressionally mandated terror drills. And the last one was back in 2005. The new one is going to be this October 15 through 19 in Portland, Phoenix, and Guam. And what they do is they test basically official reactions from the bottom all the way up to the top at the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security to see what the reaction would be like in case of a terrorist attack. The theme of this one is going to be dirty bombs. They're going to have faux dirty bombs set off in Portland, in Phoenix and then also in Guam and then see what the reaction is.
Now, by faux, you mean what?
Well, what they do is they don't actually release anything dangerous. So people are going to be okay. But they say, for example, okay, this town in Portland, there has been a dirty bomb. We need, you know, this many people to flood the hospitals and see
right.
what we
so
can
they're not,
do there.
They're not, I mean, back in the 60s, there were experiments where they were dropping what they thought were harmless bacteria from airplanes in some cities. And it turned out later that they discovered that this bacteria actually had some significant consequences for a small percentage of people.
Right. There's we're not worried nothing, like this. Nothing like
we're
that.
Not talking about, we're not talking about the release of low levels of radiation or anything like that.
Exactly. The okay. one thing that's interesting to keep in mind, though, is, you know, we do these tests so that people can see where the cracks in the system are, where there are weaknesses, so that the country as a whole and our response as a whole can be a lot stronger, right?
Mm-hmm.
This program costs $25 million a year, with the end result being, let's get safer in case of attack. Makes perfect sense to me. But this is very curious, Tom. The one in 2005, they found some serious mistakes going on. And the government, the White House, as it is wont to do, instead of saying this is what happened that went wrong and how we're going to fix it, they said, you know what, all the consequences are secret now. We won't release this report. No one's allowed to know what went right and what went wrong.
Which suggests to me that they didn't fix the problems, because if they had found problems and made them public and fixed them, then those are now fixed problems. But if they had found problems and hadn't fixed them, then those would be vulnerabilities.
Right. And there was leaked to the AP, the overall summary of this report was leaked, like I said, to the AP. And they found that one of the big problems, the point of the 2005, was biological weapons and mustard gas and things like that. And what they found was there was a huge lack of response from the federal level. And the federal government, for example, said that people who had been attacked by biological weapons as opposed to chemical weapons weren't allowed to have any disaster help. And it was this huge problem.
This is the New Orleans approach.
Well, that's the thing. That's a lot of why they want to keep it secret, because a lot of the things that they discovered in this 2005 test in early 2005 actually came true in the aftermath of New Orleans and still haven't been fixed. So they know that it could be a little bit of a black eye, and rather than fix it so, you know, we're safe in the future, they'd rather just bury it underground. And it was very interesting because you remember Tom Ridge, former Homeland Security Secretary.
Yeah, in fact, he just opened his own private security consulting firm yesterday or the day before.
I saw that.
Another pig at the trough.
he even came out, though, and said that it's unacceptable that this 2005 report hasn't been released yet. So, you know, it's what's the point of doing these things if we're not going to learn from them?
It's bizarre. And finally, we just have a few seconds left, Christy Harvey. General Petraeus making $180,000 a year. A Blackwater manager of a 34-person team makes how much?
More than double of that, yes. General Petraeus, he oversees 160,000 soldiers over in Iraq, $180,000 a year, and that's less than half the fee that the senior manager of Blackwater charges to oversee 34 people over there.
Something very, very wrong there.
Very expensive to have a mercenary army, man.
Indeed, indeed. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the Director of Strategic Communications. Thanks, Christy, for being with us.
Thank you.
27 minutes. Past the hour. Stick around. The best of the rest of the news coming up.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's our best of the rest of the news segment, where we reach out to the tubes, not the trucks of the internets, to find out what's happening in the world. Joan McCarter is with us. She is a contributing editor at the Daily Kos. Hey, Joan, welcome.
Nice to be here, Tom. How are you today?
Just fine. Thank you very much. Glad to have you with us. And Isaiah Poole is with us. He's an executive editor at TomPaine.com. Isaiah, welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us as well. Let me start with you, Isaiah. I'm wondering what at TomPaine.com, over on that website. What are you seeing flying by as the two major stories of the day? What's the hot stuff right now?
Well, obviously, SCHIP is incredibly hot, and I'm sure you've done a lot of talking about that bill, the president's veto. Just a few moments ago, in fact, our parent organization, Campaign for America's Future, put up a video, which is encouraging people to. Actually, it's a video. The theme is that no more photo ops with children until Congress votes for this SCHIP bill and overrides the president's veto.
Oh, that's sort of like asking Bush to do no more photo ops with the troops until he fully funds the Veterans Administration.
Well, there.
I think both of them will happen about the time that snow starts falling in hell, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, that is the message.
But it's a good point to make.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been watching, there has been in the last two or three days an incredible series of news articles in conservative outlets, one, the Wall Street Journal, or I shouldn't call the Wall Street Journal a conservative outlet, but
Now that it's owned by Murdoch, I'm even wary of its editorial content. I've subscribed to the Financial Times of London, and I'm finding I'm using that more and more for my business and financial information.
Good point.
I think a lot of people are.
It's an excellent publication. Anyway, the Wall Street Journal has run a couple of stories that talk about how much the Republican base is eroding. There was a story just today which highlighted the fact that a lot of the mainstream Republicans are taking more of a progressive Democratic position on free trade issues.
In other words, the progressive Democratic position being let's cut back on these insane free trade agreements.
The sort of unfettered, unregulated globalization. I think a lot of Republicans, at least according to this article, are recognizing that.
I read that article that over a third of Republicans are opposed to so-called free trade.
Right, which is that means that with a solid if you have a fairly solid Democratic front on that issue.
Well, but that's the problem. We don't. I mean, you've got Rahm Emanuel, who is still a free trader. You've got a whole bunch. You know, the whole DLC is all about that. It was Bill Clinton who signed the laws that essentially finally made free trade law, you know, with NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, all that kind of stuff. And so the Democratic Party first has to purge itself of these Republican-like Democrats, doesn't it?
But I think it should give a lot of Democrats. Democrats should not be scared of taking a more robust position against these deals.
Yeah. I mean, well said. Yeah, I agree. And the Republicans themselves are also starting to pay attention. Joan McCarter over at the Daily Kos. What do you see as the top stories? What are people blogging about on the Kos?
Today they're blogging about torture, which is sort of a hard story to get away from.
The shame of the United States.
The shame of the United States, the shame of Alberto Gonzalez, the shame of the Senate for ever confirming Alberto Gonzalez. It just keeps coming back to bite us, doesn't it? And, of course, we have the White House today denying that torture ever has happened under their auspices.
Except what about those 38 people who died while being interrogated that we know of?
But
we've seen pictures of the bodies all bruised and blackened on ice, you know, or at least some of the bodies.
It's hard.
I guess those were just accidents.
Those were accidents, I'm sure. No, Alberto Gonzalez, John Yoo, David Addington, Dick Cheney would not be responsible for that.
Yeah. The big question in my mind, Joan, is also to what extent did Condi Rice know about it? Was, on the one hand, was she kept out of the loop on this as Secretary of State, or was she brought into the loop on this and she's been supporting it or being tight-lipped and opposing it but not being assertive as a Secretary of State should?
I get the sense that she's been out of the loop,
that,
which is a disaster. I mean, that's you know, your cabinet should be working as a cabinet,
both as National Security Advisor and as Secretary of State. But I think that Dick Cheney has been fairly successful in putting up a firewall between his activities and what Secretary of State gets to know about.
Yeah, David Addington leading that charge. What's the second biggest story over at the Coast, Joan?
Well, we're looking at the Senate prospects, of course, with the news that Pajama Pete Domenici is out today, with Al Franken outraising Norm Coleman, despite Coleman's big trumpeted Bush fundraiser. And then, of course, there's always what's going to happen in Idaho. One of my favorites, being from Idaho originally.
Yeah, that's and meanwhile, just in case the Minneapolis airport is spending $25,000 to refit their bathrooms so that the next time Larry Craig comes through, he can't his feet can't wander.
I wonder if that's going to hurt at all the tourism that they're receiving from.
I think they're just getting ready for the Republican convention. Craig's
the bathroom.
Well, like they say, don't tap your feet. Don't
There you go. Men's rooms these days, it's funny. I walked into one in the San Francisco airport last weekend, and it's like they're just a lot more silent than they used to be. Isaiah Poole, I'm serious. I'm not kidding. Isaiah Poole over at TomPaine.com. What do you see on the horizon? What are the stories that are just kind of bubbling around that really we should be paying attention to that are probably going to become much bigger but are being either ignored by the mainstream media or just haven't yet popped?
Well, you know, the thing about this sort of dry appropriations process where the president is vetoing, you know, vowing to veto bill after bill after bill on the appropriations side. The thing that is missing, and I read an article today I'm not remembering exactly what the bill was, but you know, when the media writes these stories, they really ought to say that, you know, if you write that a bill is $300 some billion and it's $2 billion over what the president requested, that's a few pennies on the dollar. I think in this particular bill I was reading about today, it probably will work out to maybe 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 cents. So the thing is that you have to bring some context to all of this. And I think particularly on cable news, you don't get that context. If you read far enough on the print news stories, you might.
You mean, for example, that the S-CHIP program that everybody's talking about just represents a few months' worth of expenditures in Iraq, or that you know, some of the senior programs or even some of the vets stuff represents a few weeks in Iraq?
On our site, probably by tomorrow, in fact, we're actually going to post some of those numbers where, you know, the president has vetoed bills that represent, you could pay for these things with actually hours.
Right. These are by and large, I mean, his four vetoes, I think, are more ideological than fiscal, frankly. He doesn't like the idea of socialized medicine. He doesn't like the idea of stem cell research. It has nothing to do with its cost. But your point is well taken, and it's a very, very good way to, it's a good meme to fight the, you know, to counter meme it. Joan McCarter over at the Daily Kos, I'm wondering what the stories are that you're seeing are at the Kos that are starting to work their way up the pile.
There's been one that's been in the news for about a week. Well, actually not in the news, sort of floating around the blogosphere. And that's the degree to which our phone companies are actually censoring us, or trying to. First with Verizon and its censorship of NARAL text messaging.
Right.
Although they backed away from that. And then AT&T's, their requirement that, or their sort of secret little agreement with customers that if you actually criticize AT&T, they can cancel your
cancel your service. Which you know, for some people who are trying to get out of their phone contracts, this might be the way to do it. But really, it's, I mean, you know, this is I think Keith Olbermann last night made the comment that, you know, yes, this is the way they do things in Burma.
It is the way they do things in Burma, and it's horrifying that it's actually corporations now censoring us. So, you know, everybody's big fear is always government, but essentially now it's government is corporation is government.
And the implications that this has for net neutrality, for a free and open internet, I think are critical to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably the larger story behind the story. Very well said. Joan McCarter from the Daily Kos, contributing editor. Isaiah Poole, executive editor at TomPaine.com, TomPaine.com, DailyKos.com. Joan, Isaiah, thank you both for being with us today.
Certainly.
Great talking with you both. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up next, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., with the news of the day from that city where I'll be this weekend. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Renner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And Ellen, you and I are going to Sudan, to Darfur.
We certainly are, and we're going to go in March. Pretty excited.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to spending some time with you, too, as well. So say what, Louise? Okay. You don't want to go on the air. Louise is looking forward to it too. I think that, you know, getting me out of the house for a week.
We invited Louise, but apparently she doesn't want to come.
Okay. Yeah. Louise wants the details. She says, send me the
details.
She's
going to get the details. I had to fix my email. I was getting email in, but not out yesterday.
I see. Okay. So what's going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, I'll tell you. I feel like I lived in the Twilight Zone today, both in the morning gaggles and at the briefing this afternoon. This has to do mainly with the reaction to the New York Times article about these secret memos that were taking place at the Justice Department. And
where Gonzalez is authorizing torture in the background at the same time the department is saying we don't torture anybody?
Exactly. Some of the notable quotes this morning is that she said that they couldn't release, of course, classified material because Al-Qaeda will train to the interrogation techniques. And then Dana Perina said this morning at the briefing, I'll go through this morning and then this afternoon, she said, you don't hand over your game book to the opposing team. And then asked about commenting on it. She said, just because it's printed in the New York Times doesn't mean we should talk about it. And then she said several times, this country doesn't torture. Well, then, of course, the press this afternoon, we got into the issue of is there waterboarding, et cetera, asking specific techniques. And she said, quote unquote, this program continues to save lives. She said, we have met our international obligations. And then she says, I'm not saying that reasonable people can't disagree as to what essentially constitutes acceptable and not. And then the pièce de résistance from the briefing this afternoon was she said that under the Geneva Conventions, every country has interpreted what the Genevas mean for themselves, and we have.
Oh, my. I think you could boil it all down into one little soundbite, Ellen, and here it is.
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
Wait a minute.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I left the White House today, one of my colleagues, who knows that my brother Michael is involved in all of this, said to me, Ellen, do you really think they're torturing people? And I said, well, I am going to quote my brother Michael. This is what he hasn't said this in regard to torture, but I grew up with this expression of his I said to my colleague, is a 10-pound robin fat?
Yeah. Yep. Or is a frog's butt watertight? I mean, yeah, there's a lot of those. And in fact, we have all these stories of I think it's 38 is the number of people that they have officially acknowledged have died under interrogation over the years.
Yeah, that number did not come up today. But clearly, I mean, and it was a pretty astounding day for those of us that watch these kinds of things, and frankly, even pretty conservative press people were asking very tough questions today.
Yeah. Well, that's an indication of the weakness of this administration and the weakness, frankly, of their not just their political position, but their moral position. I hesitate to even use the word moral, although it is morality, but it's the historic American self-image position. I mean, we have always thought of ourselves as a nation that others would want to emulate. And now we've got Saudi Arabia emulating us, saying, yeah, we put thumb screws on people. Of course, the Americans do it. So.
Exactly. On a lighter foot-tapping note here, it looks like Craig is going to go. The judge in Minnesota will not let him change his plea.
Yeah, so therefore he will leave at the end of the – well, now the end of the month
is
over.
Well, he's already left, so I don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. We'll see how that shakes out. Did Secretary Rice know? I mean, this is the big question everybody's asking: is did she know either as a National Security Advisor or as Secretary of State that Alberto Gonzalez was in the background authorizing torture in ways that even other people in the Justice Department didn't know?
It's very hard to say, and obviously we're not going to find out since all of this is classified. But let's put it this way. It's interesting that the New York Times article at least talks about the fact that even major people at the Justice Department did not know about this. And, in fact, one of the things that Condoleezza Rice talked about today was the patriotism, not Condoleezza Rice, Dana Perino, sorry, talked about was the patriotism of Stephen Gradley and his Office of Legal Counsel. So clearly he knew about it, and there are other people, Comey, et cetera, that did not necessarily know about it. And so I don't know, as you know, whether they didn't tell Condoleezza Rice because then there would be plausible denial.
Interesting. And over at WorldNet Daily, Joseph Farah, my old debating partner, is calling for General Peter Pace, the homosexuality is a sin guy, to be president of the United States, draft Pace movement. You think it'll go anywhere?
Oh, good old Mr. Farah. I write for WorldNet Daily. God
yeah.
bless the guy.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, Ellen Ryder with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, it's Anything Goes Friday. Call in and talk about anything and everything. Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, our first hour, will be taking your calls about anything and everything, as he always does. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.